Hello, and welcome to the 116th episode of the Not Your Mama's Gamer podcast, a podcast where we talk about games and gaming from a feminist perspective. My name is Samantha Blackman, and I'm an associate professor here at Purdue University in wonderful West Lafayette, Indiana, where I talk about, read about, write about, think about, dream about, amongst other things, video games. And I am joined tonight by two other NYMG staffers and a special guest. Tonight we are joined by Ed Orman. Orman is the correct pronunciation, Ed?
That is right.
Yay. Who is one of the co-founders of Uppercut Games. And Uppercut made one of the games that we've all been playing recently and really enjoying. So we really wanted to get a chance to talk to him about it. And that game is Submerged. So let's run through pretty quickly and tell us a bit about who we are. And Ed, since we try to be polite around here, can you tell us a little about yourself?
Myself?
Absolutely.
Okay. So... you're my star sign, or are we starting a little bit more officially than that? I've been making games since 1997. I'm Australian, if that's not obvious from the accent. I like all kinds of games. We started our own company, I guess, 4 years ago, called Uppercut, and before that I worked with two of the other founders at a big company called 2K, which was originally called Irrational Games, who you might know from Bioshock, and a whole bunch of games like that. So we were super lucky to be working with them. But yeah, I've always loved games, but I fully lucked into getting a job in the games industry as an illustrator, and then I became a designer, and from that point on, it's just been game design.
Awesome. Okay, and we'll jump in now because we have Ashley's tonight's her first night.
Yay.
Actually on the podcast. Yay. You've read wonderful things that she's written, but now she's coming to talk to us as well. Ashley, who are you, darling?
What's up? Well, I'm Ashley. I'm a second year PhD student at Purdue, studying second language. I think I just said that. And that's pretty much all I know about myself. I'm trying to think about what I was doing in 1997.
Oh, youngin'. Oh.
I was about 11, I think. So I was off the playground, but...
Nice. Thanks for rubbing that in.
Yeah. I know. Tell me about it. In 1987, I was probably about where you are now, Ashley, in terms of, yeah.
Oh,
yeah. Uh-huh.
So you're going a little psychotic? Like, started?
That too.
So, yeah, that's about all I know. I have a cat named Pippin. Such a glorious cat. Such a glory. Yeah, and it's not from this musical play I've heard about. It's not where you got his name. It's from Lord of the Rings. I just want to clarify that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm drinking cider.
Don't tell them about the drinking yet.
Oh, I didn't know. My bad. I'm not drinking cider. I'm drinking water.
Staying hydrated.
Yes, hydration is key.
Good message for our listeners.
Yeah. Absolutely. And Bianca...
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Hi. Bianca Batty here. I am also a second year PhD student at Purdue, but I am doing 20th and 21st century American literature, which is a mouthful, and I like to focus on video games as a form of, like, contemporary storytelling, how do we tell stories in the different medias, mediums that we're seeing today, and kind of what does that tell us about ourselves? So that's kind of what I'm working on right now. Happy to be here.
What were you doing in 1997?
I was 10. I think my dad was making me learn how to play violin, and I was not happy about it. Yeah. That lasted for like 2 months. So, and then I moved on to the trumpet because that's a sexy instrument right there.
You sound bitter. Very bitter.
I mean, the trumpet is pretty bitter brass.
Yeah. There's some sore armature happening as a result of that instrument, but that's okay. I learned music, and that is the important thing. Music is important, everyone. Another good message. Stay hydrated, play music. That's what we're learning today.
Yes.
All right. For the sake of time, and so that we have lots of time to ask Ed all kinds of great questions, we'll jump into kind of quickly talking about what we're drinking. Ashley was really anxious to tell us about her cider.
I know. I love my cider so much. The cider comes from Michigan, but I'm an Ohio State fan. Just got to clarify that. And it's Blue Gold, and it's from Vandermill. It's delicious. It's apples and blueberries.
Ooh,
yummy.
Mm-hmm.
Being a native Michigander, I tell you, they make really good ciders.
Yeah, they do.
And Vandermill makes excellent ciders. The Blue Gold is good, but it's not my favorite. My favorite would have to be totally roasted.
Yeah, that's vanilla with pecans and apples.
Yeah.
And cinnamon.
Yeah.
I know my ciders.
Yes, I know. That one is amazing.
Your cider choice, though, Sam, is not always that great.
Just well.
Ooh, the shade of it all.
I try new ciders. I don't stick with the same ones over and over again. So sometimes we get some crappy ones in the bunch. It happens.
I didn't realize they're a big thing now. Like, I mean, there's been several different types out here, but it sounds like you guys have a lot more variety than us.
Oh yeah, there's like
pineapple cider. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, they have like, because as big a thing as like craft beers had become, now there's like this huge wave of craft ciders.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Which is better than beer.
It's tastier usually.
Yeah, I agree.
Goes down easier.
Absolutely.
How many have you guys had so far?
I'm not drinking cider. I'm drinking wine. So, and I have had 2 glasses already. So, you know, we're getting things going.
What kind of wine are you drinking, Bianca?
I am actually keeping going with the playing of music theme. It's called Red Guitar. Bringing it all together. It is a Tempranillo Garnacha blend. So,
is that going to be there tomorrow when I get there?
Unless I drink this whole bottle, which you never know. But I'm gonna say yes. There will be some. We can drink it tomorrow.
As she runs out to buy another bottle of first thing in the morning.
Mental note: grocery store is on my to-do list.
Don't forget the bonbons.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I got to pick her up some bonbons, too, because I am apparently Ashley's maid and running all her errands.
Lovely.
Wait, what do you mean by bonbons? No, this is a cultural thing. When you say bonbons, what are you talking about?
Yeah, like, what are they, like?
I never even cream? Actually had a bonbon.
Candies, usually. Right. But they did go through where there was an ice cream bonbon.
Yeah, there is an ice cream one. Trader Joe's has some really delicious ice cream ones.
I thought they were just like these pink mounds that were filled with stuff.
So that's what you asked for.
Okay.
Nobody wants that.
What are they in Australia?
My bad.
Is it something different in Australia?
Oh, they can mean like Christmas crackers. Okay. You know, like the can mean. It can. Mm-hmm. Certainly it's not pink stuff, filled with stuff, or whatever it was.
Mm.
that I've encountered, anyway.
Okay. Man.
I think Ashley's just making that up, but okay.
What did I make up?
The pink thing, the pink bonbons. I don't know.
No, they're like this. They're like pink, and they have like coconut sprinkles on them.
Okay.
Sure.
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay. We'll go with that.
Mm-mm. You know what?
Well, I'm going to tell you what cider I'm drinking to make it better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I am drinking a local cider. It's a soft cider. It's a hard apple cider that's sweetened with honey. And it comes out of New Day Meadery in Indianapolis. And it's actually pretty good. I picked up a bunch of new ciders this week just to try some new ones. I tried a artisanal strawberry cider earlier this week because, like, reading through Beer Advocate and Untappd, people were complaining because they thought it was too sweet. And I was like, well, if it's a strawberry cider and it's sweet, I would probably love that. But clearly, they just wanted to fool me because it was not nearly as sweet as people had complained of it being. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't what I was looking for. But this actually, it's not super sweet. It's a semi-dry apple cider. It kind of tastes like Granny Smith apples with honey. And it's really good. It's really helping that it's super cold. And because I bought the single bottles, they're the 550 milliliter bottles. So, and I'm like, I don't need a glass. I'm just going to drink these straight out of the bottle.
It's fair.
You can do whatever you like in your own home. It's fine.
Uh-huh. So I'm enjoying this one a lot.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm not drinking anything, unfortunately, so I can't join.
I was going to say, because it's like 1 o'clock in the afternoon there.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, it's only just past lunch, so it's not unheard of, but no, I'm not drinking anything right now.
Well, see, next time, if you join us again, Ed, we'll shift times and record in the middle of our day so you can drink. And we can sit back and just wish we were drinking. Actually, we day drink around
drink
here
them.
Too.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Yeah.
If I planned ahead, I could get something.
All right. So, as we said, one of the things, or the thing that we wanted to do tonight, is to talk to Ed about Submerged, mm-hmm. Because it was a game that was. It was the Xbox, they changed the name, it wasn't the Summer of Games this year, but it was one of the games that was released with the Xbox Summer of Games this year. Correct, Ed?
Yeah, okay. That's right. I can't remember what it was called either, to be honest.
I know, they changed the name this year, which made it weird.
It's essentially the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. And when it first came out, it was beautiful, and I was like, I have to have this game. So I it was one of the games that I bought, and I got like super busy and never got around to playing it until a lot of us were playing for the Extra Life Marathon that raises money for the Children's Miracle Network hospitals. And I sat down and I played the game straight through, spending far too much time just kind of exploring the world, mm-hmm. because it was absolutely beautiful. And I had a lot of feels during this game.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they were kind of laughing
she
at
cried
me.
A little.
That's awesome. I mean, it's good to hear that it made you feel things.
It definitely made me feel things.
It's very emotional.
And I have to say, at one point, I was screaming at the television. and they were like, what is wrong with you? But we'll talk more about that in a few moments. So we'll just kind of jump in and talk about and ask some of our questions. Mm-hmm. One of the bigger questions that I have is about inspiration for the game. Because as I was playing through, I was Twitch streaming it, and we were in a room with like 12 people, and everybody like at one point or another, they were watching me play. Simply because they were like, what has her reacting in such a way?
Mm-hmm.
But there was lots of questioning about what inspiration what inspiration you guys may have had when you were thinking about this game. So what games inspired Submerged?
Games-wise, we like to sort of harken back to Journey. So I play a lot of games, and I have enjoyed a lot of the non-violent ones over the last few years that have come out. Mm-hmm. Journey was one that stuck with me. But also Shadow of the Colossus, which I guess is technically, that's not a non-violent game, but you know, the focus of it is not so much on the, you know, repetitive violence. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, it had a sense of scale to it, which I really liked. So those two are ones we harken back to a lot. But also last year was Gone Home, I think.
Yes.
That one again sort of put us onto the idea that you could make a game which was a little less traditional, a little bit more focused on the story, mm-hmm. Than maybe what we'd previously done. So those are kind of the most recent examples, but there's bits and pieces from all over the place, like Eco or Ico, depending on how you say it, the one before mm-hmm. Shadow of the Colossus. I'd always thought it was Ico, but apparently I'm wrong. You know, that, again, a lot of, you can see a lot of the climbing sort of aspects we focused on for Submerged there too. But the true story, the inspiration for the very kernel of the idea of this game is a Grand Theft Auto mod, believe it or not, which was somebody had hacked GTA to raise the ocean levels, and I saw a video of that, and so you just had the city sticking up out of the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the image that stuck in my head. It was like, hey, you know, that's a really compelling idea, and that's actually a kind of peaceful place from a distance. So maybe there would be, you know, that's a setting that we could explore. And we've done post-apocalyptic games before. I've done multiple post-apocalyptic games, but that was an apocalyptic setting I thought was actually serene, as opposed to, you know, the harshness and roughness that you usually get in those. So yeah, that was the original sort of kernel of that idea, and then we sort of built on it from there.
Yeah, it's an amazing game, and before people kind of say, oh, it's a, you know, because some people don't like nonviolent games. I am not necessarily one of those people, but I prefer games where I can. This sounds terrible. I prefer games where I can kill stuff. The funny thing is for and Ashley's, I know she's probably sitting there laughing, for like the first couple minutes that I was playing the game, and I was like, when do I get to kill something? When do I get to kill something? But seriously, in all seriousness, it took about 5 minutes before I forgot that I wanted to kill something
mm-hmm.
and just wanted to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, it was a bunch of us in a room, and I was playing on my Xbox One, and Ashley came in, and she was like, well, let's take turns, and you find one thing, and then I'll find one thing, and then, like, 20 minutes later, she bought her own copy of the game because we didn't want to share anymore.
That's nice. It's one of the challenges of, there's so many new games and new types of games, and people are now, I think, inspired to try different things as we were. But because of that breadth and everybody sort of spreading out, trying different things, making sure people understand what the game is beforehand is the real challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'm glad it only took you 5 minutes. You know, some of the reviewers just never liked it because it wasn't what they were expecting. And, you know, that's on us to try and communicate more beforehand, mm-hmm. you know, this is what this game is going to be like. So, yeah, going forward, it's one of the things we kind of learned from Submerged is, you know, we have to be much more upfront about it. But I wouldn't change what the game is for the world. I'm still really happy with what we actually created.
Yeah, like I said, it's a beautiful game, and I wouldn't change it for the world either. And the interesting thing is that you say some of the other reviewers just weren't as favorable. Because it wasn't what they were looking for or what mm-hmm. they thought it was going to be. And I never read reviews beforehand, but after I finished the game, that was the first thing I said to myself. I was like, I have to see what other people said about this game.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been doing this for a while, or I've been doing this for a while. So I immediately thought the same thing. I said, so here's a bunch of folks that thought they were going to be able to kill something and lots of something, and they had that same initial when do I get to kill something thing that I had. But they never gave themselves the opportunity to look past that. Because if you give yourself the opportunity to look past it, it's the whole exploration. It's the whole exploration thing, and it's the finding of those pages that gives that kind of twofold narrative unfolding thing with the game. And that is kind of where my next question is going to go. Because that was wonderful to me, is that we had the story kind of unfolding for us in two ways. The actual story that we played through, and then the story that we discovered through those pages. What was the method to the madness for that? Can you? I don't want to kind of like throw my idea of what I thought it was out there.
So, why do we tell the story in those two ways?
A
couple of different reasons. Like, I really loved the idea of the. In most post-apocalyptic settings, I like the idea of what are the people who are left over do with the world afterwards. So I wanted to set up this idea of this culture and these villages and these people who are living off the ocean. So what would they be like, you know, and what would they do with the world, and how would they write things down? So I wanted to have that aspect reflected in the game, and so you know that's naturally that would be how Miku is going to write down her thoughts is in their language, which is this pictographic sort of thing. But at the same time, you know, we've got this fully realized 3D world, and we've got things that are actually happening in real time that you're playing through, and so that's where our cutscenes come in, and that's where we show you, you know, like the front story of like this is actually now what's happening. But we wanted to marry those two things, so you know, like why are they in the city, and why is she going around in the 3D world doing these things, and what brought them here? And so those two stories. That's why we did the pictographic one for the past, and the real 3D world for the company of present. But there's also obviously this, the other story is, you know, the city and what happened to it, which again, as you know that sort of gets revealed through exploration, and who's writing down those pictograms is sort of still a bit of a mystery that we wanted to leave in there. But it felt right that we would use the pictographic pictographic form for selling that story.
And I really like how that like incorporates us into the way that narrative unfolds and is told, you know, at playing through the games and sort of encountering these fragments, these images as we keep playing, and having to be really active participants in constructing the narrative of the city and of, you know, of the characters and everything, ourselves. And so that, for me, that level of engagement was really fascinating and cool, and really made me feel like, you know, how the game tells its various stories was really interesting to me. And that's what I think was one of the coolest things to really think about, was how this makes us, you know, think about how games can tell stories in different ways. And in the case of this game, in ways that are, you know, more about experience and images and what we encounter, as opposed to, like, heavy dialogue and things like that. Yeah. So I really loved that part of it, personally.
Well, the thing, to get really boringly technical, briefly, you know, there are techniques that we've been using since that I learned working on Bioshock 1, you know, that about, well, putting story into the world itself, but also revealing story in pieces. You know, there are logs in Bioshock 1. There are characters that you get to know. You know, you never meet them, but you get to hear their logs as you collect them. And that technique's been used by a lot of different games now. But one of the things I really like about the pictograms is that they're not absolute. They're not directly, it's not somebody telling you, well, this is how I'm feeling, and this is the series of events that happened. There's a lot left up to you to sort of interpret. So even when you get all of them, there's still some ambiguity there, and I really like that. I like not having an answer, specific answer to all of the questions.
That was super fun. I was just, like, sitting in my living room talking to myself as I was playing, like, ooh, what does that mean? Okay, that's lightning, maybe? Okay.
But especially because also you get to reinterpret them, too. You come up with all of these answers for what does this pictogram mean, but when you get four of them in a sequence, you might go, oh, okay, actually this one here didn't mean what I thought at all in that context. So, it just lent an extra edge to it, which I really liked.
Well, I'm going to stop asking a million questions, and I'm going to reserve the right to come back and ask another one or two in a second. But we'll jump forward and say, Ashley, what about you, honey?
Oh, I have so many thoughts. I still consider myself a newbie when it comes to games, and I think what I like most about your game is that it is narrative-based, and there are so many things that are going on that you pay attention to. I think one of the things I was really curious about was the idea of these, like, the creatures and how I thought that they were evil at first because that's what you kind of expect in a post-apocalyptic scenario, especially with kids who are, like, orphaned and abandoned. You're like, oh, God, here's these creatures. She has no gun. She has no arrow. They're going to all die. Everybody's dying. but you don't really see that they, as you notice, they seem more like guardians kind of leading her, even to some of the supplies that she needs for her brother. And I was wondering if you could just kind of speak more to their intended role and what inspired that, the kind of ambiguous relationship for me as a player and other players.
I think what we discovered once we had some of them, we call them remnants, and there's an entire backstory about how they came to be, but what we discovered once we got some of them into the game was that we got a really good tension arc out of them, which is exactly what you're describing, which is people would see these creatures, would expect something of those creatures, and then have a realization, you know, about them. And it pretty much happens for every one of them. Even halfway through the game, a lot of people were still, you know, having the expectation of trouble. But then you have that release of, no, it's actually okay. You know, you would have encountered the whales, for example, when you're boating around too, and they very much, like, a lot of people run away from them. The first time they appear, people get terrified and turn the boat in the other direction.
Nope. I went with them.
Well, there you go. You're one of the brave people. But yeah, it's funny. It was kind of nice to play with people's expectations, especially in a video game. You know, if there's an enemy there, you're expecting to have to beat it up with a stick or shoot it with a gun or something. But instead, we got to have these nice, ambiguous creatures that are hanging around. And, yeah, eventually you start asking questions about how much actually are they helping you.
Mm-hmm. So are they a product of the environment having changed? Or because she was changing with the game. And so it almost seems like she was going to turn into one of them. And then they're like, no, you don't have to be one of us. Stay human.
Well, I'm not going to do any spoilers. But I like our ambiguous story. You know, like, what did you think they were like by the end of the game?
Oh, is that a question for me or other players?
Yeah, well, it sounds like you built up some assumptions.
It seemed to me that she would have changed eventually, that she was coming in contact with the elements. There was some kind of causal factor that was shifting her appearance, but not her brother's because he wasn't coming in contact with it. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was the water or whatever caused the water. If there was, like, I'm not really sure what happened, but yeah, it seemed like she was going to become one of them and then die. And then her brother was going to die and then everybody's just going to die. Mm-hmm. But I'm very happy that it was.
It's a pretty grim setting. It is. You know, for a non-violent game, it is still a fairly grim setting, and part of that's kind of the fairy tale, old fairy tale aspect, I think, which was super grim. anyway, you know, even though they had happy, some had happy endings or some had good moral lessons in them. You know, this is still a post-apocalyptic world, still not a happy place. Mm-hmm. But we wanted to have that as a backdrop, not the sort of main thing about the, you know, the story that we were telling. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not going to directly answer.
Yeah. No, it's fine. That's I'm fine. Not mad about it.
But I have to say that is the part of the game, Ashley, you were watching me stream this.
Yeah.
But that was a part of the game, like at a moment when she encounters them up close and personal, I literally started crying and screaming at the television, going, "What are they doing to her?"
It was very emotional.
It was extremely emotional, and for, you know, for a number of reasons, because you start to write your own history for these characters that you call remnants, mm-hmm. As you play through the game, because you don't know, mm-hmm. you know, where they've come from or if they, you know, have nefarious intentions. So you're like, you start to write your own narrative for them. And like Ashley says, because you're in a post-apocalyptic world, we're so used to any remnants or people who've been affected by the apocalypse in some way being nefarious characters, that to see them as anything else is almost impossible at first blush. So, mm-hmm.
But see, and I also think the strength of doing it this way is you guys have written in your heads a better story than I could ever write. seriously, you know, like I've done game stories before where we're very specific, and you know, we have, you know, everything is laid out for the player, and you know, we spill it all out, but I actually think it's probably more compelling what you're imagining the background is than anything I would have written down in my notebook. So it's awesome to hear that that's what you were doing, is filling in the blanks.
Okay, Ashley, do you have more questions, or you want to jump over to Bianca?
I have so many questions. I kind of want to go back to the idea that it's non-violent, because even in the construction of Taku and Miku, I mean, there is that element of abuse that kind of emerges.
Yeah.
And so even though it's not immediately in the play, it feels violent because you know that they're children and you know what happened. Mm-hmm. And it, so, like, what went through the process of kind of merging that that kind of violence with a non-violent apocalyptic, I can't say the word correctly. Goodness. It might be the cider. It might be the cider. I don't know. apocalyptic scenario, if that makes sense.
So, you know, the game was not initially non-violent. That's something we came to. You know, we created... Whilst we had this idea of exploration being really, really key and mm-hmm. having this really serene-ish place to explore, there was a time when we were going inside the buildings, not just climbing on the outside of them, and we prototyped some stealth mechanics and, you know, some pretty standard combat, and it wasn't gelling really well. Like, I don't think we got it to a point that we actually really liked. But it also, I think it was after GDC last year, we just kind of had this realization that we just didn't need it. Mm. The game was, the game was about the city, and every time we were going inside, we were losing the city. But also, you know, tracking around outside in the boat at your own pace was just the thing that we enjoyed the most out of it, and I think it presented the most serene experience. So we chucked all the combat out. And once you chuck out combat, you chuck out health systems, you chuck out all of these traditional things that have come with other games, and you free yourself up to focus on the other things, like the story. So that was a really pivotal moment, but it was really good. I'm really glad we did that.
Yeah.
What I still wanted to write a more personal, I guess, story than I've done for other games. Like, a lot of the time we're doing saving the world, you know, superheroes, which are great and the kind of thing I like, but I wanted to do a here's a girl who's just trying to save her brother story. So it was meant to be much more simple And you know, their backstory is actually fairly straightforward once you find out what it is. But that was just the simple story that I wanted to tell. But it needed to be serious, and the threat needed to be real. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's kind of a pretty unhappy beginning for those guys.
Hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. I hope that answers it.
No, it does. I'm pondering. Sorry. I ponder. And since you can't see my face, you can't see my pondering. So it looks like, oh, no, I didn't like that answer. That's not true. No, I'm pondering. I mean, I like the fact that you did cut out the combat because it does make you focus on a story. And like I said, I'm new to the whole gaming thing, but I like GTA like anybody else, mainly because I like shooting people, right? But I like the development of the story most in Submerged, and I really like the relationship between the brother and the sister, mm-hmm. probably because I relate to it on many different levels.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that made it more special for me mm-hmm. in that process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also, when I was 11, my younger sister was born, so I always had this sort of extremely overbearing sense of responsibility towards her, even though, you know, my parents were great and I didn't need to have it, but I remember I had nightmares about, you know, having to look after her. So I always had this I like that relationship.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I've got a 10-year-old and a 2-year-old, so again, I could see that sort of relationship forming back when my 2-year-old was born as well, was that my older daughter was very much like super careful with her and really wanted to take care of her, and I like that. I like mm-hmm. the sibling sort of relationship that you can have.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I have a similar age gap between me and my youngest brother. I was just mm-hmm. about 11 when he was born, so there was an instant nurturing kind of maternal thing that took over. And then even just recently, one of our staff members, Alicia, her son, it's just so sweet with his little sister. It's adorable, and how he does push-ups at night so he can protect her if something happens.
Yeah.
2 and 7 or 8.
Yeah, 2 and 7.
So I think that's just really, like, a sibling relationship is just very special when mm-hmm. when it's able to be molded correctly in an environment that nurtures that. So.
And I know you probably, I think it's one of your questions about this is, you know, like, why did we choose a girl as mm-hmm. the main character?
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of related to that. Like the straight up answer is because why the hell couldn't we? You know,
yeah.
Maybe,
so
we can do whatever. Yeah. Well, we can do what we want. It's our own world that we're creating. And why wouldn't you have a female protagonist?
Mm-hmm.
I've done plenty of games. Like our previous, the first games we made with this company were, you know, the main character is a robot, so it's quasi-ambiguous, but really it's a guy. You know, like, we treated him like a guy, and most of the main characters in the other games I've worked on are all men. But, you know, I've got 2 daughters. Mm-hmm. I've also played, I don't know how many games where it's male protagonists to start off with, so why not just do something different for once?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really appreciate that, because I have a 7-year-old daughter as well, and she's gotten to the point now that, you know, we play a lot of games together, and she will ask, why can't I play as a girl? Why are girls not available? Why is this character not female? Like, she still doesn't understand why Link is a playable character and Zelda is not in Legend of Zelda.
That's why I said that the other, like, they've announced the new female Link, and I'm like, that is terrific. For whatever the game is, you know, the Dynasty Warriors sort of game.
Yeah.
But why don't they make the next Zelda game let you choose character?
Exactly.
You know, let you choose. Exactly. Because it would mean nothing almost to the game.
Mm-hmm.
They've almost always been interchangeable anyway. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. But yeah. My eldest doesn't really bring it up often, but she appreciated the fact that it was a little girl who was the hero in this game.
Yeah,
And she likes, I think games like Little Big Planet or things like that where the sex is essentially irrelevant anyway or non-existent, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I think she likes those more because you can make that connection, and it's really easy for guys to sort of brush that off because we've had that connection all along. So
mm-hmm.
we caught stick, by the way, from people who are like, why can't I choose a boy to play your game? It's like, because production budgets and stuff, mm-hmm. but the story wasn't about a boy, it's about a girl, so live with it.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And you can choose 95% plus of any other game on the market and play as a boy, mm-hmm. and only be able to play as a boy.
Yeah.
I think the ideal, unless you're making a game, like our story was specifically about Miku, so I wouldn't do it in a game like Submerge, but in a game where it doesn't matter, I would rather try and build the option in to have any gender that you want, like, because why not?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Bianca, darling?
Yeah, one question I have is, you know, I know we've sort of talked a little bit about the setting, this post-apocalyptic setting, and how striking it is that this setting is a little bit different than a lot of the apocalypses, is that the correct mm-hmm. plural? that we usually see, again, going back to, right, apocalypticos? I don't know. No, apocalypses. And those, and again, going back to that idea of this being a more nonviolent sort of a setting than most of the apocalypses that we see. And so that sort of contrast of the knowledge of maybe violence that has been happening in the environment to create all of this destruction, but it's still this very serene version that we are witnessing in the aftermath. And so I've been thinking a lot about how that converses with other apocalyptic settings. And so I was wondering, you know, what maybe inspired you to do this different version of that, how you think it maybe converses with other post-apocalyptic settings, and, you know, kind of what the process was in constructing it in this way.
Well, the very nature of being on the ocean, I think, is mm-hmm. is a trigger for a lot of people for serenity. And mm-hmm. you know, like, I think you can probably find beauty anywhere. You know, I'm playing Fallout 4 now, and I think it's a great-looking game. I don't know if they've ever particularly striven to create, like, a beautiful moment or vista in there, but maybe one exists. But yeah, the peacefulness from just having the ocean setting is an immediate win, I think, if you're trying to set it up like that.
Mm-hmm.
The process of how... it's pretty convoluted how we came up to the visuals, I guess,
mm-hmm.
because we had that base idea of, you know, like, it's going to be this peaceful, essentially empty city. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's another thing, removing people from your world is another way of making things feel a lot more peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
But so we had that basic idea of this sort of empty city that the girl's boating around, and then Andrew, you can see over my shoulder, but anyway, he really came up with the aesthetic, I guess, of having things overgrown.
Mm.
And that was our, you know, you want to have the ruins, and there is something peaceful about the ruins, but having things growing back over it and having something nature-y or natural... Mm-hmm. You know, sort of reclaiming things is where mm-hmm. it started to become it's more like a, I don't know, in my mind it's kind of like, you know, going for a walk in the bush and coming across a waterfall. It's that kind of place now. It's somewhere that can actually be peaceful because of nature and not just because of what came before.
Yeah.
I'm not describing it super well. But
that's great.
But it was very... to use an overworked phrase, it was very organic. Like, we didn't start out with, hey, we're going to do an overgrown ruined city. It was like, this is going to be a ruined city. How are we going to, you know, make it look good, and how are we going to emphasize the sort of serenity of it? So, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really think that's so interesting with, like, the rebirth, the resurrection of nature, you know, through all of this, too. But also, like, that sort of tension created, I think, as a result of this sort of watery apocalypse, because, like, I'm terrified of water. I'm terrified of drowning. And I listened to this podcast called Lore, where he talks about, like, lots of scary things and kind of historically their trajectory and sort of traces that. And the one I listened to today was, like, about the ocean and shipwrecks and ghost stories that come out of those sort of historical shipwrecks too. And so I've been thinking about that, and because I've just been thinking about water a lot lately now too. So, and so, like, I think that that's another tension in the game for me too, like, that the creatures that we've kind of been touching on with the creatures too, where you're like, I don't know, maybe the way that we encounter games typically makes us sort of feel like we should be afraid of these creatures, and then that the game sort of dismantles these preconceptions for us. And I feel like the water is doing that for me too, because I see water and I go, uh-oh, someone's gonna drown. But that wasn't necessarily the case here. It was just another sort of dismantling of my notions of the destructive nature of water, and how maybe in this game, you know, there is that serenity as a result of it too, and that that rebirth that we see in nature. So I really liked that sort of duality being complicated as a result of that setting for me. So that was something.
No, it's a natural fear as well too, and especially I don't swim in the ocean. even though we're in Australia, we have great beaches, but I am terrified of things that may be underneath me at any given moment.
Yes.
Probably from some childhood incidents with some stingrays and things like that. So,
oh, my goodness. Yeah.
I'm not a big fan, and it does hold that sort of fear for me, exactly what you're talking about. And there's a in-world story reason for why Miku doesn't swim. You know, a few people have asked about that too. But again, I don't want to fill in that blank, but there's a reason why you don't want to go in the water and submerged. Mm-hmm. So there's a reason why she doesn't swim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have one or two other quick questions that one of our other podcasters I wanted to ask, but she herself kind of is submerged.
Oh my gosh!
Her house flooded.
Oh,
oh no! Oh,
that's not good.
Not at all.
So they were doing
as in weather flooding or broken pipe flooding.
Their power went out, and she's on a well, and let's just say that the water might not have been all the way turned off when the power came back on. So she's doing some cleanup tonight. But she had questions, and she said, "Well, you have to ask at least this one." And it's the question about research. And she asked specifically, "What research did you have to do to create this world?" And what research did you do specifically to create these characters?
So it lots of different areas to touch on there, I guess. I guess if we're just talking about the world and not, like, obviously the engine or the technology behind it, because the programmers do a lot of work to actually make it this kind of large-scale world render and all that sort of stuff, but I don't think that's really what she's talking about.
Yeah, but she's talking more about narrative construction, yeah.
Right. It's kind of on the design art side. Again, Andrew did a lot of sort of trawling the internet for ruins. And there's, there's sort of classical stuff like, you know, Mayan temples that have been overrun by jungle and things like that, which have their own feel. But then there's more recent things, you know, there's whole towns that got flooded when a dam was built, but then the dam got taken away, and so those towns have been re-revealed, and there's sort of modern, World War II era, you know, lanes of cars that were overgrown because they were abandoned after the war, and just all those sort of visual cues. We looked at a lot of those. This fascinating thing, if you ever want to look into it, because they have, all of those places have a really attractive vibe to me, and it is this post-apocalyptic thing. I think the idea of basically getting rid of everybody is what, sometimes I kind of like that idea of, like, you know, living in a world without anybody else, when people get kind of frustrated. I think it's why it's an attractive fantasy. So visually wise, that's kind of that angle. Narrative wise, the kinds of characters we were making, I think I already touched on this, but we're talking about constructing this post-apocalyptic society and what they would be like. Mm-hmm. And given our location in the world, we were, thinking about the nearby oceanic sort of civilizations that have grown up in, we're in New Zealand, Papua New Guinea, and, they share a lot of commonality with Hawaiian societies as well. Mm-hmm. So those were, we took a lot of visual cues from there. We wanted to make her not white, because we didn't think it would make sense for that society and for those people. If those are the people who are going to live through this kind of apocalypse, then, maybe the majority of the people now are of Maori descent or Islander descent of some kind. And then, for the story of what happened to the kids themselves, there's no personal story to be told there. Mm-hmm. I was more looking for I wanted Miku to not just feel that natural sense of responsibility that we have to our siblings. I wanted her to actually be responsible for what's happened to Taku, or at least feel like she should have acted differently or prevented what happened to him in some way. Mm. So really, if you read through that the pictograms of that, you'll see that there's a sequence of events there that she could have had an effect on. Yeah. That's about the depth to which I researched that particular situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say you guys did well, because I have been lucky enough to have seen some of the Mayan ruins, and that was as I was playing through the game, that is something that kept coming back to mind. Was Mayan ruins. And it was beautiful. And you talked about it earlier in terms of this kind of reclamation, nature's reclamation of this space. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when you first start playing the game, it's like, oh look, it's a space, and there's like plants growing everywhere now. But then as you play and get deeper into the story, mm-hmm. and nature does what nature does, mm-hmm. right, and becomes more aggressive with that reclamation, mm-hmm. it changes the way that you interact with the space as well, and it makes you feel differently about the space, mm-hmm. yeah. right? So it becomes less of a hindrance, mm. In terms of, this is irritating hindrance, mm-hmm. And more of a, well, of course the plants would do this, and of course the water would do this, because this is meant to be here, mm-hmm. and we are the ones who are the interlopers in this case. Mm-hmm. And to see that and with the remnants and with what is happening to Miku as you play through the game, it's like, it's almost like a natural progression of things.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say I'm super jealous you've seen real Mayan ruins, because I'm on the wrong side of the planet. One day I'd like to, but it's a long way away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is definitely a sight to behold.
Yeah.
So, and I'll ask one last question and then give you a chance to tell us anything that you want to tell us that we didn't ask you about, because we've asked you 500 questions today. But
I feel like you've covered a good gamut, but hit me with another question.
Okay. He's like, you've asked me everything there is.
Well, we've got more. Don't worry.
Well, this last one is about the game itself, and the way that the game gets played in the fail states, right? So, mm-hmm. One of the ways that some people define a game is through the addition of a fail state. But in Submerged, the only way to fail is to give up.
Mm-hmm.
Why that choice?
It's kind of a natural progression from, take out combat and you remove a health bar. So, okay, mm-hmm. so now she no longer has this concept of health. if she doesn't have health, then what does dying really mean? What is failing by falling off a, you know, obviously there's a lot of climbing, so if she falls off a ledge, what does that mean?
Mm.
Do we reload the game from where? Where's the checkpoint? And why do we even bother doing that? So plenty of games in the past have had instant death because you fall off something, which I've always found incredibly infuriating, especially if it was an action that, I mean, yes, I'm in charge of this character, but sometimes you're playing some pretty character-driven games. It's like, well, why did that guy walk off the ledge to his death then? He's an idiot. You know, it's not right. He should have known. He can see the ledges right in front of him, so he should know. You know, more modern games have implemented things to sort of account for this, where you push off the edge and they'll catch on, or they just won't fall off. But for us, it was just the ultimate progression. It was like, if we're just going to kill you because you fell off a plank, and then reload you 30 seconds back to, you know, so you can do it again. Why are we letting you fall off the plank in the first place? Miku wouldn't fall off the plank. You don't want her to fall off the plank, and if you did want her to fall off the plank, you know, you would have specifically wanted to input an instruction to do that. So once we knocked that out and took that away, it was just natural that there should be no failure states in the game. And now you know you can't fail. That tension is removed, and you've got different tensions that you can focus on, like what's going on in the world in this story. So yeah, it was just a very natural sort of slide away from the combat stuff towards the let's focus on the story.
Oh, that is so cool.
I admittedly tried to make her fall, but
everybody does.
Fall off.
Everyone tries to make her drown. Everyone tries to make her fall to a death.
I love that. I love what you said though. Like Miku wouldn't. She wouldn't fall off. Like yes, oh. That is such. I love that. That's all I'm going to say about that.
So, we always ask this question at the end of our interviews. Is there anything that we didn't ask you that you would like to share to tell us about, I don't know, the way things are in the world? I don't know.
This is one of the most in-depth ones on the story, so it's actually been really nice. So thank you for that. The one thing I'd probably mention is, you know, one of the other things that affected some decision making was last year, obviously the controversy of like Gamergate and a lot of the sort of high profile press that got, and a lot of the attitudes that were coming out online, which I really despised and didn't agree with, and I thought it pretty much showed one of the darker sides of humanity in general, but also for game development. You know, there was a lot of, I just thought there was a lot of negativity coming out of it, and I was really proud that we'd already chosen to make a female protagonist, you know, because for reasons which were explicitly because, you know, we wanted to have a woman in charge of this game for once. And there was a lot of flack going around last year, you know, for people who were making exactly that kind of decision, and I just thought, well, screw you guys. It wasn't a decision that was made in direct response to things like Gamergate, but I was really happy that we could be, you know, doing something that was kind of against a lot of the ideals that the group, the hate groups that were around were espousing.
That's an awesome answer to a non-question.
Yeah.
And one that we really appreciate.
Yes, I'm so pumped on that answer.
Awesome.
Well, Ed, thank you so much.
No worries.
One, for joining us tonight, or today for you, or tomorrow for you, actually.
You're a time traveler.
Yeah.
And two, thanks to you and all the folks at Uppercut for making this awesome game.
Yes.
No worries. Thank you.
Yes.
So, one other quick question. There, you guys are working in the background. What do you have coming next?
We've got nothing to announce. We're doing a small game and a big game. So the small game is mostly because the two other founders have both just had babies. So they've both got, I think, 7 or 8 week olds. So things have been a bit quiet in the Uppercut office, so we thought we would try and make something small whilst they have some family time. And then we're working on a more of a long-term, larger game But they're both very different games again. Like, one of the great things about running your own company is you get to decide what you want to do, and we like making different things. So no Submerged sequel, sorry. it'll be something different again.
Cool.
That's good.
We're
too.
Definitely looking forward to see what comes next.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for playing. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for making something for us to play.
Exactly.
I'm
sorry, I cut somebody off. So I guess with that kind of brings us to the end of episode 116. And as we said before, thanks so much to Ed Orman for joining us and time traveling back to yesterday for him to talk to us about this game. It's something that we've really enjoyed. Mm-hmm. And as we put out this podcast, it actually won't come out tomorrow, but it will be released on regular schedule. And when this podcast comes out, we're also going to start a contest, and we're going to give away a copy of Submerged for one lucky listener. Yay!
Oh, cool, yeah!
Because I think more people need to play this game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So that'll be fun, and we'll see what people think. And that, as I said, that brings us to the end of episode 116. And until we come around to episode 117, I would like to say, as always, stay warm, stay dry, and as always, my friends, game on.